From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. American presidents like to get off and running while their victory is fresh, their leverage is high. Donald Trump launched his first 100 days this weekend in acrimony and vitriol over truth and falsehood, alternative facts. But he's made big promises. For action, the clock is now ticking. This hour On Point, we launch our 100-day spotlight on the opening moves of the Trump presidency. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What do you see coming right out of the gate? What are you expecting of President Trump's first 100 days? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. The president sat down with business leaders this morning, started right in on regulation and taxes. Here he was saying that he will cut regulation.
We think we can cut regulations by 75%, maybe more. But by 75%, have, in a certain way, better protections. But when you want to expand your plant, or when Mark wants to come in and build a big, massive plant, or when Dell wants to come in and do something monstrous and special, you're going to have your approvals really fast.
Something monstrous and special, and taxes, said the new president, they're also coming down.
We are going to be cutting taxes massively for both the middle class and for companies, and that's massively. We're trying to get it down to anywhere from 15 to 20%.
15 or 20%, that would be corporate tax rates. Okay, here we go. First 100 days have begun, well begun. Now joining us today from Hillsborough, Virginia, is Kimberly Strassel, columnist and member of the editorial board at the Wall Street Journal. Kim Strassel, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
And from Washington, Howard Fineman joins us, Global Editorial Director for The Huffington Post. Howard, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And from Washington, Molly Ball, National Political Writer for The Atlantic. Molly Ball, welcome to you.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here.
Kim Strassel, what do you make of the president's first weekend and this start of this day? Business leaders right out of the bat. We're talking about, they're in the White House with him, Elon Musk from Tesla, Kevin Plank from Under Armour, Marilyn Houston from Lockheed Martin, and more. What do you make of these first couple, 3 days, the start, Kim?
Well, the business really starts today, and you could see that just from the announcement of his schedule. He's not only got this meeting with businesses and union leaders, he's meeting with congressional leaders later today. He's having conversations with foreign officials. He's pondering executive orders. He had made it clear this would be the kind of start of real business. I think for those of us that are free marketeers, watching him with corporate America this morning has been a little bit reassuring, because up until now, this has been Donald Trump in his interaction with the business community has very been much about the stick part of it. Lots of threats about leaving the country, bad things that would happen to them, border taxes that would be imposed on those who produce goods overseas. This is more Donald Trump talking with carrots, talking about how he's going to make America a better place to create and start and run businesses, and talking about both regulations and taxes.
Of course, plenty of confusion about that. Yes, business people this morning, and not the stick, but encouragement there. At the same time, the word out of the White House is that, and we don't know at this hour, but that Bloomberg is reporting that he will sign an executive order today, Monday, withdrawing the U.S. from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP trade deal with Asia, of course. Had Lindsey Graham on CBS Face the Nation yesterday saying, be careful, what does America First mean? Does it mean protectionism?
To the president, if America First is a throwback to the 20s and 30s isolationism when it was first used as a phrase, the world would deteriorate even quicker. If it is a new way of Ronald Reagan peace through strength, I'd like to work with you. I don't know what America First means.
Lindsey Graham isn't sure. Over the weekend, Donald Trump visiting the CIA, trying to reassure them after his tough attacks on them in recent weeks, was all about his relationship, well, a bunch about his relationship with the media. Pretty vitriolic language.
I have a running war with the media. They are among the most dishonest human beings on earth.
Molly Ball, what do you make of the president's first couple of days here? And now we're off on Monday. He's got business leaders, union leaders today. What do you make of the start?
Well, Trump has always sort of reminded me of the classic reality show contestant who shows up and says, I'm not here to make friends. It's very clear that he is not, even at the very beginning of his presidency, interested in making unifying gestures to broaden his appeal. He's very much trying to divide and conquer, leaning into the base of passionate supporters that he already has, even if that means that he's quite unpopular with the broad swath of Americans. And the question now is what he actually wants to do. There's a lot of confusion about that. I've been talking to a lot of particularly Republicans on Capitol Hill about what they expect from the Trump administration. And they feel like they've been getting a lot of mixed signals. There's a lot of hope that this could lead to a sort of golden age of conservative policy if they get to do a lot of the things that they couldn't under a President Obama. On the other hand, there's a lot of consternation of the type that you heard Lindsey Graham voice, that the things Trump wants to do may not be what they consider conservative policy, that if he wants to do things like protectionism, which Republicans had previously mostly been against, he may encounter some resistance from the Republican Congress. So there is a lot of unity around things like regulatory reform, the idea that the Trump administration is going to repeal a lot of regulations, particularly around the environment and around labor. But there's not any consensus around how they're going to proceed on Obamacare and on anything else that may be on Trump's agenda.
Howard Fineman, there's policy and then there's tone. Now, policy takes a little more work. Tone was set right over the weekend, pretty acrimonious tone. What do you see coming on both fronts, and how do they interact, Howard?
Well, to use a phrase, this weekend in terms of tone was both monstrous and special.
for better and worse.
It's unlike anything I've seen, and it started the moment that Donald Trump walked out to be sworn in as president. I've been to a lot of inaugurations. I've been there in person to witness history and to get a sense of things right from the start. And my sense right from the start is that Donald Trump wants to operate by picking fights and winning them. That's his theory. That's the theory that he used to rise within the real estate business in New York, and that's the one he's going to apply.
What's
worldwide.
The logic behind that, Howard? We have headlines here in the Wall Street Journal, Kim's paper, about deliberate chaos being a strategy here. What's the strategy in the strategy?
Well, I think that is part of it. I think Donald Trump thinks of everything as a negotiation, as everything of a deal that he's ultimately going to make, by undermining the power and the credibility of his opponents and even the people that he's negotiating with. He always wants to be the last man standing. That's how you get to build the building. He'll use any tool that he needs to do it. I think he and his people have a look-back theory that relates to Ronald Reagan, where Ronald Reagan was always, quote, going over the heads, unquote, of the media and of the Congress to use his support in the country to get legislation passed. But the problem with that analogy is that Ronald Reagan at times was a very popular president and was called the great communicator for a reason, and had, I think, at his height, a lot broader swath of the country behind him than Donald Trump has right now. But Donald Trump's calculation is that it's not a 50% game, it's whoever's standing, and whoever has a plurality, if not a majority, is going to have the clout. To Molly's point, whether that's going to actually work on the Hill, I don't know. They have a majority in the Senate, the Republicans do, but it's a pretty thin majority. And it only takes three Republican senators to get off the reservation to prevent Trump from doing what he wants to do legislatively. So, but in terms of NAFTA and in terms of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, he's going to rip those up because he thinks that somehow by trashing them, he'll get a better deal later.
I want to get down to policy particulars, but the tone of this weekend was remarkable. The White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer came out. No questions, just a statement to reporters on Saturday, and it was right in their face.
There's been a lot of talk in the media about the responsibility to hold Donald Trump accountable. And I'm here to tell you that it goes two ways. We're going to hold the press accountable as well. The American people deserve and deserve better, and as long as he serves as the messenger for this incredible movement, he will take his message directly to the American people, where his focus will always be.
Okay, great. But in the course of that statement, Spicer himself making demonstrably false statements on NBC's Meet the Press on Sunday, host Chuck Todd asked Kellyanne Conway, counselor to the president, about those falsehoods. They got into a tussle. Here was that exchange. Alternative facts show up.
Don't be so overly dramatic about it, Chuck. You're saying it's a falsehood, and they're giving Sean Spicer, our press secretary, gave alternative facts to that. But the point remains.
Wait a minute. Alternative facts? Alternative facts, four of the five facts he uttered. The one thing he got right was Zeke Miller. Four of the five facts he uttered were just not true. Look, alternative facts are not facts. They're falsehoods.
Kim Strassel, how do we go forward here? I want to talk policy, but this issue of what's even factual was on the table right away this weekend. How are you thinking about that, Kim?
Yeah, so I think a top line thought here is that obviously this was not how the Trump administration should have spent its first couple of days in office, which was having a back and forth with the media over the issue of how many people actually attended or watched the inauguration.
Yep.
I mean, this is a president who says he's got such a big agenda, and we heard very little of it. Now, you heard many of his advisors complaining that the press wasn't focusing more attention on Democratic obstruction of their nominees or some of his first policy initiatives, in particular his executive order on Obamacare. But the bigger point is that it was hard for anyone to focus on that because the Trump team itself was spending so much time, you know, in the president's remarks at the CIA and the Sean Spicer event, talking themselves about crowd size. So, this is just a lack of focus, and that is something that has a potential always to derail this incoming administration. But, you know, on the issue of the press, though, look, Howard makes a good point, which is that Trump seems to operate only or at his best when he has somebody he is feuding with. And we should all be honest, this is not going to stop in terms of him being aggressive toward the press, because one thing that the Trump team does know is that the press itself doesn't have a fabulous amount of trust as an institution out there among Americans, and so they feel that the press is a good foil. I think the bigger problem for the administration is they're going to have to choose the fights that they pick.
Kim, hold the thought there. We have to take a short break. We'll come right back to you. We're talking about Donald Trump's first 100 days. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about Donald Trump's first 100 days as part of our On Point 100-Day Spotlight on the opening chapter of this presidency, looking at the new president and his plans, his prospects. It's day one of our 100-Day Spotlight here. We're going to be all over it. Molly Ball is with us from The Atlantic, Howard Fineman from Huffington Post, Kimberly Strassel from The Wall Street Journal. You can join us in this hour as well. What do you see coming in the first 100 days of President Trump? Trump supporters, what do you want? What do you expect? Trump opponents, what do you want? What do you expect? And will this White House get the facts right to get the job done? Here was Donald Trump, president, being inaugurated on Friday.
The time for empty talk is over. Now arrives the hour of action.
And what will he do? A lot, he said.
We will build new roads and highways and bridges and airports and tunnels and railways all across our wonderful nation. We will get our people off of welfare and back to work, rebuilding our country with American hands and American labor.
All right. Sounds great. Right off the bat, big questions about what's honest and true. Molly Ball, how do you see an action plan unfolding? Is there an action plan? Are the priorities clear? We've got already an executive order on the Affordable Care Act. I'd like to know how you see that. The TPP, we're told, is going to go down under his pen today. What's the sort of order of attack? Do you know? Does anyone, Molly?
Nobody knows. Even within the administration, as you pointed out earlier, there is a lot of uncertainty, and so much of it does rest with the Congress. You know, the people in Trump world that I have spoken to understand that the expectations are very high for them to achieve something, to create a sense of momentum and a sense that now that he is in charge, he can actually get things done. And so, you know, the cabinet picks getting through, the Supreme Court nomination, which we expect to come very soon, these regulatory orders, I think those will go a long way toward convincing at least some Republicans that he is moving quickly. But the rubber is going to meet the road quickly when it comes to some things where he has significant differences with the Republican Congress. And those are on things like Obamacare, where it is not at all clear how they plan to proceed. There was the executive order, and no one is quite sure what it even means or how it's going to be implemented by the federal apparatus and what the consequences might be for the insurance market or for individuals.
What did it even say, the Affordable Care Act executive order? Is it clear what the impact of it is?
It is not clear what the impact of it is. You know, I don't have it in front of me, but it basically is instructing all of the federal agencies responsible for implementing Obamacare to create exemptions wherever it causes a hardship, not only for individuals, but for businesses, for insurers, et cetera. And so, you know, the people that I've spoken to who are experts on this, I am certainly not a healthcare policy expert, are saying that, you know, it could potentially allow a lot more people to opt out of buying coverage, but it could also mean that employers could stop participating in Obamacare. It could create problems for the insurance industry, particularly if there continues to be a vacuum in terms of what the Congress plans to propose to replace Obamacare, assuming that they're able to repeal it fairly quickly, which is another one of the near-term goals that Trump has set.
Howard Fineman, how do you see the interplay between the White House and Congress on the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare?
Well, first of all, let me say I think the executive order was meant as a signal, I think in part to the insurance industry, that if they want to opt out and if they want to back out of marketplaces, there's a way. And it's an invitation to do that. It's an invitation to let the system try to collapse of its own, especially in the marketplaces. He can't do as much immediately about Medicaid spending and the extension of Medicaid spending and so forth, which is a big part of Obamacare. But he can tell the insurance companies, hey, don't worry. And I think that was the point of the executive order. More largely, I agree with Molly. Nobody really knows. They don't know inside the administration exactly. And it's all under Donald. You know, Abraham Lincoln used to walk around with all the letters under his hat, his big stovepipe hat. Well, Donald Trump has it all inside his head, how he's going to use his deal-making skills to threaten and then somehow come to a deal that is going to create jobs by renegotiating the global economic system, which is what he's essentially proposing to do. And with Congress, in terms of building all those roads and building all those tunnels and everything, that's going to be largely, I think, through tax credits and other kinds of inducements to private industry to get involved. And that is going to be very controversial and not easy to pass through Congress.
Why would that be controversial, Howard?
Well, because the Democrats, for one, don't trust further tax breaks to business as a way to necessarily get public works projects done. And also the idea of privatizing the infrastructure of America, which I think is what Donald Trump is up to, is a very, very controversial idea in and of itself. Do we want to turn the highway system and the tunnels and the bridges and everything over to private companies to profit from public infrastructure? And that's what Donald Trump, I think, is going to ultimately propose when they get around to actually saying something. And the reason why the media aspect of this is so important is that there will come a time when we're not judging crowd size, but jobs created, numbers of tunnels and bridges and so forth constructed. And they want to control the media. I would add one other thing. Sean Spicer said, how dare the media, at a time when Donald Trump was trying to unify the country, which is an arguable proposition to begin with, but let's assume that it's true, he was trying to unify the country, how dare the media sow division and not get on board with the effort to unify the country. Well, our job isn't to unify the country. Our job is to report the facts.
And
end of speech.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
If stating the facts is sowing division, then we're in a funny world.
We're in a funny world, and that's the one we're going to be arguing about henceforth.
I want to bring out all of that to you, Kim, but callers first here. Bloomfield Hills, Michigan. Bill is calling. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Hi, Tim. Great panel. The biggest story over the weekend is what Howard, I think, was just talking about, and that is there's a war on the press. The first thing authoritarian leaders do, which Donald has been trying for ever since the campaign and continues apparently with spades, is to discredit the media. And until that's effectively responded to, we're going to have a problem. I think the Republicans need to respond to it because no one else has any credibility in responding to it. And I think our Republican leaders need to come out and say that there were lies over the weekend by the press secretary from the White House.
Bill, let us pick it up. Kim Strassel, can you see Republicans getting into the middle of the what Donald Trump himself called over the weekend at CIA headquarters a running war with the press? Is there a bipartisan urge to stand up for facts here, or do we head into some new arena?
I can guarantee you the chances of Republicans inserting themselves in between Donald Trump and the press are absolutely 0%.
Okay.
That's not going to happen. Look, there's a time-honored tradition, in particular in Republican circles, all political circles, but Republican circles of beating on the press. Because, again, as I was mentioning before, the reality is in institutions, yeah, media doesn't necessarily command a lot of respect out there among Americans. And I'm not just talking about Trump supporters, but Americans in general. So,
but historically, Kim, we don't usually argue about whether or not it was raining. You know,
Which goes to my point that this was not a battle that they, mm-hmm, should have picked as their first fight with the press. Mm-hmm. I mean, look, I think you also have to add in here, and again, this is not to excuse any behavior over the weekend or any, you know, some of the questionable points made about facts. But look, this is also an administration that feels sorely done by the media over the past year. It feels as though you had leading newspapers in the country's television stations that were outright rooting for Hillary Clinton in the lead up to the election.
But a lot of people say the media made Donald Trump in the primary season and beyond.
Oh, I don't doubt that there is a reality to that as well, and that they had him on TV all the time because he is entertaining to watch. But in terms of sort of coverage and the way he was portrayed, and the sort of respectful stories about her and not so respectful stories about him, I'm not saying this is right or wrong. I'm saying the administration definitely feels as though the media has never wanted him to be in the office he is in now. And that is going to color the way they approach the media from here on out.
Kim, can I ask you on the face? Donald Trump said this morning that he wants to cut regulation, by which he would mean federal regulation, by 75%. Now, is that just negotiation talk? Is that anywhere in the realm of possibility? That would gut federal regulation, you know, down to a fraction of what it's been. Is that just business talk? What is that?
Well, we absolutely have to assume that it's an open negotiation. Look, you go and you read Donald Trump's books, you look at all of his history of business dealings. We do have a pretty good sense of how he operates in some way. And it is indeed to always come out with some very striking position in the beginning, which then you'll note he often sort of backs away from slowly, and it ends up in a more nuanced position. Look, as somebody who's been hugely alarmed over the amount of regulation that came up, in particular over the past 8 years, I doubt you get to 75%, but there is a lot of low-hanging fruit out there. And to go to Molly's point about a plan, you know, in some ways, what we're going to see happen in Washington is really going to be a department-by-department thing, in that Trump has picked people who have very, in some ways, expansive visions about how they could reform or dramatically change the departments that they're about to take over, and simply dismantling or redoing regulation could be a full-time occupation for 4 years for many of these new department heads.
And we've already got Democrats calling the new president out on that front. You had the New York Democrat, Chuck Schumer, Senator, asking, he was asked why they were going pretty slowly on cabinet picks. Trump has less in place than is the norm here. Schumer says it's because the nominations are riddled with conflicts of interest. He called the cabinet picks a swamp cabinet.
I think he's trying to use populist rhetoric to cover up a right-wing agenda. If you look at his cabinet, they are far from the populism that he talked about.
Well, we'll see where they steer their enormous departments in Washington. Kevin in South Bend, Indiana. Thank you for calling, Kevin. You're on the air.
Thank you. How are you?
Okay. What do you see?
I see, I want to talk about a little bit of privatization of the infrastructure and what do you think about doing. From what I heard, he was going to be giving tax credits to the private companies that would be redoing our roads and our tunnels and bridges, et cetera.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if the companies are going to be getting the tax credits that are equal to the amount they built on the roads, or how are the companies going to, I don't know, rebuild without the money first?
Yeah, and surely that's a big issue for people, Republicans especially in Congress, but everybody there. Molly Ball, how does that actually work? A tax credit, does that require that when the road is done, it's a toll road and there's a toll going into that the builder's pocket? Or you know, you hear the question out of Indiana, does Congress still have to appropriate the cash?
Yeah, I think that this issue of infrastructure is one of the most interesting potential sort of litmus tests for how the Trump administration is going to proceed. The, you know, the question that you had Chuck Schumer asking in that quote, is this just sort of a Republican agenda cloaked in some populist rhetoric, or does the Trump administration actually plan to pursue a lot of things that another Republican president would not have done? So one of the ways that we will see this is when they get around to proposing an infrastructure plan or working with the Congress on an infrastructure plan, is it based mostly on, you know, tax credits and incentives for private companies, which most experts on infrastructure will tell you that is not going to accomplish the work of rebuilding all the roads and bridges and airport terminals that Trump has talked about in some of his speeches? Or is he going to do the kind of thing I've had people in the Trump administration tell me? He's going to come up with something that actually is going to make a lot of Democrats happy in terms of actually spending government money to create jobs for people, you know, people who work with their hands to actually build things. Now, one of those things may be a wall on the border, which I think Democrats would not be as pleased about. But they've already started to move forward on funding that with government money. And will they also use government spending to do a more traditional type of infrastructure spending, which a lot of Republicans in the Congress have been against, seeing it as, you know, government-driven, as a sort of stimulus plan that spends too much money and potentially blows up the deficit. So that's going to be one of these places where the rubber hits the road in terms of policy, where we really get to see what kind of administration this is.
Kim, what do you see coming here? Do you see lots of new stuff being built and at the end of some number of years and being launched right now in this first 100 days, we've got new infrastructure in this country. Is there a deficit that follows that? Our caller out of Indiana, I guess, is wondering, do tax credits build it? Is it a privatized world on the other side of the Trump push?
We likely will see a lot of infrastructure, but I would not be surprised, and I think everyone, again, this gets to the type of nominee that Trump has put into or put forward for a lot of these positions. And it gets to some of the confusion of the Trump administration in that this is arguably one of the least ideological presidents that we have ever had in office. He is himself not necessarily someone that operates on very conservative principles. However, the people that he has chosen for positions are, in fact, very principled, conservative leaders. So I would not be surprised to see a complete overhaul. If you're looking, for instance, at Elaine Chao, who's been nominated for the Transportation Department, just blowing up of the entire traditional structure that we even have for funding infrastructure, like the highway fund, for instance, and the formula by which money is dispersed back to states, maybe combined with something to do with tax credits, maybe combined with something to do with sort of federal money flowing back out. It might be a sort of root and branch redo of the traditional system.
Howard, mm-hmm. do we end up with the shiny stuff, the new stuff, and is it all owned by somebody else and we put a quarter in, you know, or 10 bucks in to walk in?
I would guess, based on talking to people in and around Trump world and knowing how he operates and how he thinks, that this is going to be a glorious opportunity for private companies to get a more direct role in not only the construction but the operation of infrastructure. And you mentioned Indiana. The caller from Indiana knows that Mitch McConnell, as governor of Indiana, privatized a big highway there, basically sold it to a European company, and we're going to see a whole lot more of that.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Blue Apron is the fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service you've heard about. Its mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to all. They support a more sustainable food system, set the highest standards for ingredients, and make it easy and fun to cook. You decide which recipes and how many meals you want each week. Change, pause, or cancel anytime. Learn more at blueapron.com/onpoint. Go now and get your first 3 meals free, plus free shipping at blueapron.com/onpoint.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Donald Trump's first 100 days, the new president and his plans, his prospects. Right now, it's day one of our 100-day spotlight at On Point. We are going to be all over it. Molly Ball is with us from The Atlantic, Kimberly Strassel from The Wall Street Journal, Howard Fineman from Huffington Post. You can join us this hour. Trump backers, what's most important to you? Now, right off the bat, Trump opponents, what should Democrats in Congress do? What's the message in the huge protest across the country this weekend? In his inaugural speech and before, the president, Trump, has promised a lot. Said a nation exists to serve its citizens on Friday.
Americans want great schools for their children, safe neighborhoods for their families, and good jobs for themselves. These are just and reasonable demands.
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders on Face the Nation yesterday saying, let's not focus on atmospherics, but on keeping promises to the American people.
The best thing that Mr. Trump could do right now, today, is to send out a tweet and tell the American people that during the campaign, when he said over and over and over again that he would not cut Social Security, cut Medicare, cut Medicaid, tell the American people that he was not lying, that he's going to keep his word, and that they do not have to live in anxiety.
There's Bernie Sanders on Face the Nation yesterday. Alan's calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Alan, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks. My biggest concern is based on what's already happened, the initial actions. And that is that the healthcare system will become unstable as a result of the repeal with no replacement in sight. The administration will blame it on the Affordable Care Act, saying it was already collapsing, and then claim credit for rescuing the system with whatever they do, which will likely be less than what's there now.
And you fear the American people end up with something less. I mean, Molly, how about it? If there's a policy here of deliberate chaos, Kim's paper, The Wall Street Journal, reports, could it put things at risk, put the health system at risk, maybe more?
I think that's certainly a possibility. However, I would say that a lot of Republicans, especially those in Congress who are going to have to stand for election in 2 years rather than four like the president, are very concerned about the potential political fallout once they are seen as owning whatever's happening in healthcare. And even if there is an attempt to blame any chaos on the remnants of the Obamacare system, I think most of the Republicans believe that once they've taken action on this issue, anything bad that happens to people's health care is going to be blamed on them. We've already seen Republican members of Congress getting blowback in their districts from people worried about the future for the health care system. And they're very concerned that if they take action and the insurance industry, the health care industry is destabilized as a result, people losing insurance for whatever reason, even if it can be traced back to problems problems that were originally caused by the Affordable Care Act, they're going to own that politically, and they need to take action to address that potential political damage. And so there's a lot of concern about the repeal and replace strategy, what the timeline is, how to reassure insurers that they are not going to be left with the bag, how to prevent the government from having to spend a lot of money to shore up the system. And so this is not something that Republicans are assuming they can avoid responsibility for when and if the system does start to respond to the actions being taken.
Kim Stressel, can we take that same angle of interest or concern into trade? Now, Donald Trump may act or may have already acted by the time some of our listeners get this show on the TPP today. Is there a risk, Kim, that the trade becomes so unsettled or uncertain that it begins to gum up the flow of trade, and with that, the U.S. economy, the global economy?
Well, the actions that he is taking today or has taken today on both the Trans-Pacific Partnership and NAFTA shouldn't necessarily cause a great deal of upheaval, because he was very clear that that was what he intended to do on the campaign trail. I think what's important to watch for, and for, in mm-hmm. particular for businesses and those who care about free trade, is this question of what replaces that. Because what you seem to hear quietly from the administration, somewhat within its actions as well, too, is that this isn't necessarily an outright hatred for any trade, but rather a dislike of big, vast trade deals. And so we have heard, for instance, that when Prime Minister Theresa May of the United Kingdom comes
on Friday
this week, on Friday, that one discussion might be a bilateral trade deal between the United States and Britain. If this is the route that the Trump administration pursues, which is not an end of free trade, but a different form of free trade done aggressively, that might even provide more security to some companies in the markets.
Security to companies? But what about the economy overall? Republicans have argued for years that it was active global trade that meant economic growth. We know the fruits have been distributed unequally, but that's been the argument.
But what, if
Howard,
I can jump in here, I think what Donald Trump and a lot of his supporters and some of the theorists who work for him, like Steve Bannon, object to is the growth of large international organizations around these multilateral trade deals. That's what they're what sticks in their craw and what they want to get rid of. They would prefer to have Donald Trump himself, the master negotiator, do these bilateral deals that all flow through the United States, so the United States maintains its America First control of things. They don't like the UN. They don't like the EU. They don't like global institutions that they feel get in the way of America's prerogatives. And that is a pretty deep Tea Party idea that Donald Trump tapped into and is kind of like the molten core of his so-called movement.
I guess the question is that workable? America's been multilateral for a long time.
No, it's not workable necessarily, but I think they're going to try. And I think Kimberly's right. That's going to be their approach, country by country, and it all flows through Trump. And the other part of it is, this is all about Donald Trump being the person who forges the deal, who does the jawboning, who's the action guy. You know, now begins the time of action. I mean, that was a statement in the inaugural address that you know sounded like it was carved in stone. That's what Donald Trump wants, and he wants to be the center of the action, including on trade.
But Barack Obama, one of his big messages to his successor was, no one man can do this job alone. It's too big for that. Is that wrong, Kim Stressel?
No, it's not wrong. But again, look at the Trump administration as it is forming. What you're going to have here is a president who does make big, bold, grand statements, and yes, will probably be the sign-off on many, many things. But the caliber of some of the nominees and their experience and what they care about doing are probably going to be the lead on a lot of the initiatives that begin and building them from the ground up. Again, this president will probably have the final say, but he has put people around him that, you know, at least within conservative world, get a lot of credit.
When you talk about caliber, who are you talking about in particular? I mean, when I looked at Rick Perry there in energy after having, you know, real scientists in there, I'm not sure how he stacks up. Betsy DeVos, I don't know what her success has been in Michigan with charter schools. Where do you see the strongest points of high-caliber cabinetry coming here?
Tom Price, a doctor, knows healthcare inside out.
Yep.
You know, I myself, I don't necessarily have the same misgivings about Rick Perry. Rick Perry, I mean, I know that only a small portion of the Energy Department is about energy development.
Our whole nuclear infrastructure there?
Yes, our nuclear infrastructure, but, you know, we also have a ginormous infrastructure of federal bureaucrats who also are all PhDs. This is about having someone at the head who has a vision. Mick Mulvaney at OMB knows budgets inside out, spending control. Ryan Zinke at Interior knows regulations inside out. So, I mean, I think that there are actually quite a few people there that that do. I mean, again, their priorities might not be what some Americans would want them to be, but I don't think their experience and their knowledge is in doubt.
Let's go to Rodney in Mora, New Mexico. Rodney, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have a comment. You know, there was a time that people were rallying against something called the New World Order. And it seems to me that the United States and Russia are going to align and create this New World Order. And your commentators, whatever, I would like to hear what they have to say about this, because it seems to me that this order is going to be an oligarchy. And it's exactly what the Republicans and the Russians want.
Republicans, and it gets very confusing here in a hurry, but I appreciate your call, Rodney. Howard, what about on the foreign affairs front? You've got Theresa May coming, of course, she who came to power in the UK with Brexit. You've got the Benjamin Netanyahu coming to the White House, we're told. You've got all these reports about Donald Trump, even, you know, up in his very high in his security apparatus now, investigation about connections with Russia. In terms of global organization, Kim points out that there are people there, Steve Bannon and more, who are not keen about the international institutions that have been built over so many years with American leadership in building those. I don't know if 100 days reconstructs this, but where does it point, the global order, if that's the right word for it?
Well, I do think we are now in a new era, that the one that was constructed even as World War II was being fought, the international order that the so-called wise men in America constructed, and that the world has seen since 1945, I think is under assault. And I think that nationalism, with or without populist tones, is where we're headed. What that's going to mean and who's going to profit by it isn't entirely clear. People like Donald Trump and even Vladimir Putin announce it in the name of the people with a capital P. That's what Donald Trump did at his inauguration. He even said it was a decree of sorts, which is an odd word in an American inauguration. And I think that is going to involve big money and big global corporations in concert with governments. And that's going to be the vision here in the United States with Donald Trump. Oddly enough, in a post-communist world, that aligns to some extent with Vladimir Putin. I think it's going to be about strength. I think it's going to be about control of the nature of public discussion. And I think you're also seeing the beginnings of an alternative to that, inchoate as it is, in all the demonstrations that took place on Saturday around the world. It's going to be feminist. It's going to be, as I think Ben Smith and BuzzFeed wisely said, it's going to focus on Muslims for the reason that they are, as he put it, I think, the canaries in the coal mine of Western life, meaning that if we can't deal equitably and equably with them, how can we uphold our own values? So there's a new conversation that's being created around the world, and Donald Trump is very much a part of it. Now, ironically, Theresa May, who was forced to lead the Brexit implementation, mm-hmm. is going to be coming here, having done that in the UK, to argue for NATO, to argue for the Baltic countries' protection, to argue for the existing system. But the fact that she's the person who's going to be arguing for the existing system that I was talking about, yeah. the post-World War II system, shows how weak and fractured it is right now.
Britain out of the EU, but still very much in NATO. It feels right. like a shift from the American government standing for principle to something more purely about power. And no doubt that's very much involved in what pulled so many people out this weekend in protest.
Well, Donald Trump said in the inauguration, we're done telling other people how to run their affairs. In other words, countries can run themselves the way they want to.
Okay.
And we've thought that we had the moral duty to stand for certain global universal principles of human rights, the human
but
rights.
But that wasn't just out of philanthropic notion. That
no,
was making the world safe for democracy, including our own.
I understand what the intention was, and I think it's overall worked pretty well from 1945 until 2017. But Donald Trump is clearly proposing something else, and I think people around the world are realizing that, which is why more than a million people turned out in cities around the globe.
Yep. Phyllis in Newton, Massachusetts. Phyllis, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. I'm concerned. We're talking about the quality of people. I'm really concerned that Michael Flynn, who wasn't vetted at all to be National Security Advisor and is now under investigation because of his possible links to Russia, is going to be sitting in security briefings. Is there any way that he could have his security clearance removed until after the investigation?
Interesting. Phyllis, thanks for your call. Kim, your paper has reported this, that this investigation is going on into Michael Flynn connections to Russia. How does this work when the president's overseeing the whole federal apparatus now and parts of that apparatus are investigating his own inner circle? How does it work, Kim?
Yeah. We just don't know enough about this yet in terms of what he's actually being investigated for. I mean, there were reports that came out about him supposedly making phone calls to a Russian ambassador on the same day that the administration announced sanctions against Russia. The Trump people have dismissed this as just a kind of diplomatic formality.
I mean, this is your paper putting it on page one, Kim.
No, I'm not disagreeing. I'm saying that, but look, we don't know what the investigation is finding, if this is a routine thing that they must do, given
but our caller's question is, how does this administration function when you've got an investigation going on of people right in the heart of it?
Well, you depend on by the way, this would help a lot. It would be very helpful if Democrats would actually confirm some of Donald Trump's nominees so that you could have a functioning Justice Department, you know, have a functioning different branches of the investigatory agencies that need to look in this. I mean, we depend to a certain degree, and those have been muddied because of the politicization of departments over the time, but we depend in a certain degree about having an autonomous Justice Department and else to sort of be able to conduct fair and free investigations.
Well, let's look for fair, free, and autonomous today. Those all sound like good words here. Of course, Howard, you met Mitch Daniels earlier talking about Indiana governor. I know that people just writing in about that. We're off and running here with this new administration. On Point's 100-Day Spotlight will stay right on it. Kim Strassel at the Wall Street Journal, Howard Feynman at the Huffington Post, Molly Ball at the Atlantic. Our deep thanks to each of you for getting us going today. Thanks to all. Listeners, stick with us. Off we go. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.